snapped Benford. I don't like it either, but she cannot hesitate or be aware of the canary trap.
She'll figure it out.
What if she's so pissed she quits, said Forsythe.
Then this converts to world-class debacle.
I hope she'll see it our way, said Benford.
You have the Greek cops all set?
It's all arranged. She'll be arrested the morning after the call.
Gigantes, Greek baked beans.
Sauté onions and garlic in olive oil. Add peeled chopped tomatoes, beef stock, and parsley, and boil until thick. Add cooked gigantes beans, mix well, and bake in medium-low oven until beans are soft and top is crispy, even lightly burned. Serve at room temperature.
Chapter 38.
Vanya Igorov was in his office working late. The sky had gone from pink to purple to black, but all Igorov noticed was the flat-screen monitor showing endless stories from Greek television, Eurovision, the BBC, Sky, the American CNN, about the incident in Athens. The Athens residentura had confirmed that the dead man was Sergei Maturin. Vanya felt his bowels flip when the resident informed him that the Greeks, inexplicably, had already cremated the body, making a forensic autopsy impossible. Inexplicably my ass, thought Vanya. The CIA owned the Greeks, had for years.
Not important, not now.
Vanya knew someone else had authorized the wet work in Athens, had dispatched the pie-eyed psychopath to Greece. Not the director, not his counterparts at the FSB, not even the dwarfish Zhuganov. Only one possible name. As if sentient, the Veche phone trilled, making Igorov jump in his seat. The familiar voice came through brutally, rasping and ragged but evilly calm.
The operation in Athens was a disgrace, said Putin.
Is he in his stocking feet, thought Igorov, shirtless?
Yes, Mr. President, said Igorov dully.
There was no point in stating that he had not authorized it. Putin knew.
I expressly specified that there be no special tasks.
Yes, Mr. President, I shall investigate.
Leave it, said the voice.
I looked for more successes from you. The loss of the senator is colossal. The mole in your service remains active. What are you doing to track this traitor down?
If you had resisted your monstrous urges, thought Igorov, we might have him in the bottle.
As you know, Mr. President, I assigned a skillful officer to exploit the American handler. I was hoping for important information.
Yes, your niece. Where is she now?
Here it comes, the worst.
She is unaccounted for in Greece.
Silence at the other end.
What is the probability that she is dead? Asked Putin.
Don't sound so hopeful, thought Vanya.
We are waiting for word, said Igorov.
Another long silence.
Dominika was a bigger threat to the president, more than the espionage flap in Washington, bigger than a mole in the service.
She needs to come home, said Putin. See that she is safe.
Which meant, ensure that she will never, ever talk about the Ustinov intriga, the action, whatever it takes.
Whatever.
The line went dead.
Dominika was missing. If not dead, then presumably in hiding. How she could hide alone in the Greek capital was a mystery. This little sparrow must be resourceful, he thought. There was news footage of a cordon of gray and white Greek police vans around the Russian embassy. The Greeks had considered the possibility that a Russian fugitive would seek refuge in the chancery. News accounts included reports of another man. They didn't have Nash's name. Had Dominika gotten anything out of him? Had the CIA killed Dominika, captured her? If she was alive, he had to get her back. Spasenie, salvation, would be possible. The telephone on his desk purred. It was the outside line and therefore nothing important.
What is it? He snapped.
His aide, Dmitri, was on the line.
"An outside call patched in from the duty officer, sir," he said.
"What is this nonsense?" Igorov raved.
"A call from overseas, sir," said Dmitri. "They traced it to Greece."
Igorov felt the skin on his head contract.
"Put it through," he said. Dominika's voice came over the line.
"Uncle? Uncle, can you hear me?"
"Yes, hello, my child. Where are you?"
"I cannot talk long. It is very difficult here."
She sounded tired, but not panicked. "Can you tell me where you are? I will send someone to you."
"I'd welcome the help. I'm a little tired."
"I will send someone for you. Where can we meet you?"
"Uncle, I have to tell you that my friend, the young one, began talking. I made good progress, like you hoped I would, but your man, that Dijavol, almost killed us both."
"What happened?" asked Igorov.
"They fought. My young friend fled. I do not know where he is."
"The young American bested a Spetsnaz-trained fighter?" Igorov wanted to know.
"No, uncle. I killed him. He would have killed me."
There was silence on the other end of the line.
"Christos, Christ," Igorov thought. "What a demon."
How could she possibly have liquidated Matarin? His hand on the receiver was wet.
"I see. What did your young friend tell you?"
"Yes, something strange. He bragged that the Americans had just caught one of your spies, a woman. He said she was important. I told him I did not believe him."
"You can believe it, all right," thought Igorov.
"He told me you had tried to mislead the Americans, telling them the spy was sick, unable to work."
Igorov was about to scream into the receiver to tell the little idiot to get on with it. He could feel his own pulse through the earpiece.
"That's most interesting. Did he say anything more?"
"Just that the spy did not really have eye surgery. It was a false trail, and the Americans saw through it. My friend seemed quite proud that they had caught the spy," said Dominika.
"And now they will be less pleased when they lose their own spy," thought Igorov. "Korchnoi."
"Nothing more?"
"Korchnoi."
"Nothing, uncle. Our conversation might have continued if we had not been interrupted."
"Yes, of course. Now we must get off this line. Where are you? I will send someone for you. You must stay out of sight."
"I have been staying with a man I met, a stranger, in his apartment. He promised not to turn me in if I was nice to him."
"That's what you trained me to do, isn't it?"
Igorov missed the irony in her voice. "Can you stay there for another day? Are you calling from his phone?"
"I think I can stay, but I have to go out to call. I abandoned my phone in that hotel. The man has no phone, only a mobile. I would not like to use it to call you. There is a kiosk across the street. I'm calling from there with a phone card."
She gave him the name of the street and the building number in the working-class neighborhood of Patisia, north of Ammonia Square. "Be at the kiosk tomorrow exactly at noon," said Igorov. "A car will come for you. The driver will mention my name. We'll get you back home. In the meantime, stay off the street." He broke the connection. If they could recover her, Igorov thought, he would be safe. He would cover her in medals if they bagged Korchnoi. First, a telegram to that Durak in Athens to see if that jackass could manage to pick up an officer under hot pursuit, then order 24-hour coverage on Korchnoi. No alarms, no alerts, no exfils by the Americans. Even as he steeled his circus strongman's body for the weight, he began thinking about his old colleague who had betrayed him and helped the Americans find Swan. "Get me Zhuganov," he called to Dmitri. The Athens residence cable arrived the next day in Yasinyevo at close of business. It described the scene as two SVR officers entered the Patisia neighborhood to approach the kiosk and collect Dominika. They reported that no fewer than 6 Greek police cars and 20 police officers in white helmets and flak jackets
were milling around the kiosk. It was chaos. The SVR men could not get close, but they saw two female police officers lift a handcuffed woman up the rear steps of a police van. They described the prisoner as dark-haired and thin, nothing positive but likely Dominica. She was in their hands. Not 2 minutes after the arrival of the cable on his desk, the Veche phone on the credenza behind Igorov's desk began trilling with a sound unknown in nature. It was past midnight, and the Moskva River Bend visible from General Korchnoi's living room was a black ribbon between the high-rise lights of Strogino. The apartment blocks across the river were newer than the buildings on this side. Construction cranes still towered above unfinished units. Marble made a favorite dinner of pasta alla Malika, tossed with anchovies, breadcrumbs, and lemon. After washing up, he brought a glass of brandy into the living room, checked his watch, and went to the bookshelf that ran along the wall. He slid a small paring knife into the joint of the top of the shelf, wiggling the blade to release two catches mortised into the wood. The top of the shelf opened on concealed hinges like a coffin lid, exposing a shallow compartment. Korchnoi reached into the cavity and pulled out three gray metal boxes wrapped in a clean cloth. The first two were each the size of a cigarette pack, the third flatter and wider. Korchnoi connected the two small boxes end to end by fitting their tracked rails together. The flatter box, with a tiny Cyrillic keyboard, was in turn connected to the first two by a pinned plug. A stylus lay in a slide clip holder. Using the stylus, Korchnoi depressed two recessed buttons to illuminate three tiny LEDs. The first was the battery power indicator. Green, go. The second indicated whether the integral antenna in the top component could read the U.S. Milstar Block 2 geosynchronous bird. Green, strong signal. The last LED indicated whether the transmission exchange, the rukopazitya, the handshake, had been completed. Yellow light, stand by. Korchnoi used the stylus to depress keys to compose a routine message. He wrote plainly, eliminated spaces and punctuation, cryptic economies learned over the years while preparing secret writing letters. He missed the tactile process of SW, rubbing the paper, preparing the inks, the featherweight pressure while printing the block letters. He worked sitting in his armchair, the reading light over his shoulder, an old man on a vermeer canvas bent over his work. There was utter silence in the room. The message composed and signed Nico, the free-from-duress indicator, Korchnoi pushed the transmit button and watched the yellow light. His message soared heavenward in a super-high-frequency burst, washed over the satellite, tickling its sensors. The already stored reply was activated and returned on an attenuated signal in the Q-band in the space of 3 seconds. Moscow slept. The windows of the Lubyanka were dark. Yet Korchnoi had reached upward to touch fingertips with the main enemy. The LED winked green. Handshake. Successful exchange. Korchnoi unwrapped a cord from a recess in the keyboard unit and plugged it into the input jack in the back of the small color television he had received from a CIA officer in a midnight trunk-to-trunk exchange 3 years ago along the M10. The set had been modified by the CIA, and Korchnoi turned it on, selected a preset channel. Three keystrokes with the stylus and the snowy blank screen turned black, blipped once, then turned black again, displaying two words in light typeface. Message, none, it read. The period was missing. That was the real message, the signal flare. Game begun. Korchnoi turned off the television, coiled the cord back into its compartment, shut down power, and disassembled the COMO equipment. He wrapped the components in the cloth and returned them to the concealment cavity, closing and locking the lid. He returned to his chair, his book on his lap, and took a sip of brandy. He reached up and turned the reading lamp off and sat in the darkness of his apartment, looking out at the city lights and the black river, certain in the knowledge that the SVR had seen and recorded everything he had done in the last 30 minutes.
From August to October 1962, the KGB mounted blanket surveillance on Colonel Oleg Penkovsky of the GRU, including in his apartment overlooking the Moskva River. The colonel at the time was passing the West voluminous intelligence on Soviet ballistic missile capabilities. Officers of the FSB surveillance unit, who more than five decades later were watching General Vladimir Korchnoi, were too young to remember that Cold War case, but the measures they employed to gather evidence against their target were nearly identical to their predecessors. Across the river from an apartment in a partially completed high-rise, three teams of watchers used colossal yoke-mounted naval binoculars to watch Korchnoi orient his COVCOM equipment to an azimuth of 13 degrees to communicate with the satellite. From the apartment directly above, Korchnoi's watchers had down-drilled pinholes in the ceiling of three rooms fitted with fish-eye lenses and stick microphones, both slave to digital recorders. They had watched Korchnoi access his bookshelf concealment device, assemble the components, and poke out his messages on the keyboard. They did not have the angle to read words off the screen of his television set, so they lowered a remote-head video camera on a fiberglass spar down the outside of the building to record words on the television through the living room window. Unlike with the Penkovsky case, they did not need 3 months. They had enough. Midnight. Across town, another team was going through Korchnoi's office in the Americas department on the second floor of Yasenyevo. Apart from a thorough physical search of the office, desk, credenza, and containers, technicians minutely took swab samples from a number of surfaces. Keyboard, desk drawer pulls, safe handles, file folders, teacup, and saucer. The next morning, Zhuganov brought in the lab report and Igorov slapped it out of his hand. Mietka indicated in trace amounts, inside doorknob, right edge of desk blotter. Analysis, compound 234, lot number 18. Host, Nash N. Amerikanskij posolstvo, the American Embassy. Korchnoi returned home from Yasenyevo after work, the early twilight bright over the trees along the river. His legs were leaden and his chest felt constricted as he walked along the esplanade from the metro stop. The building was quiet but for the murmur of television sets behind the doors. The smells of cooking food were heavy in the corridor. The instant Marble opened his apartment door, he knew he was caught. The key had always stuck. He normally had to jiggle it to turn the lock. Tonight, the cylinder felt silky. They had sprayed graphite in the keyway to lubricate it. There were five men in his apartment standing in a semicircle around the front door. Rough, lean faces, square-jawed and hard-eyed, wound up. They wore jeans, track suits, leather jackets, and they swarmed the old man the minute the door opened. He knew enough not to resist, but they grabbed his legs and arms and picked him up off the floor. They moved quickly, silently, a forearm around his throat, two others specifically holding his arms. "They always pick you up," he thought. "But where am I going to run?" He said nothing as they forced a rubber wedge that smelled of drains between his back teeth, not to be biting down on cyanide capsule, please, comrade. And they stripped him to his underwear, never letting go of his limbs. Not to be using weapons or buttons or needles in clothing, please, comrade. They forced an ill-fitting tracksuit on him and carried him boldly down the stairwell, passing at least 10 other men in leather coats standing on the landings. He was wedged into the back of a dark green van, their hands never letting go of his arms and legs. Pain ran through Korchnoi's body. He was losing feeling in his arms where the men were gripping him tightly. "It doesn't matter," he thought, preparing himself for the next chapter. He knew what was coming. The ride in the windowless van was long. They rocked violently as it made turns, joust when it went over tracks, and tilted as they went around a traffic circle. Korchnoi knew where they were headed. He could track their route west through the city. When the van doors were flung open and he was dragged out, Korchnoi looked up. He thought he should take one last look at the sky,
tonight inky black with an orange city glow, and breathe the air deeply, likely the last time he could do so. As they manhandled him to a small door, he also looked around quickly to confirm what he knew already. The crowded courtyard was littered and dirty. Bleak walls of unfinished cinder block were topped by a jumbled lattice of barbed wire. The familiar ochre walls of the Y-shaped five-story building were unmistakable. Lefortovo Prison. Korchnoi knew what was inevitable. Vyshaya Mira, the highest punishment. He knew his final stop, Bratskaya Mogila, an unmarked grave. The only choice remaining to him was the manner in which he would go out. He already had decided not to make it easy for them, and that ironically meant he would talk, freely. But just not about what they wanted to hear. To the mounting discomfort of his interrogators, he told them he had not been spying against Russia, rather he'd been spying for Russia. First to defy the Soviet system, the system that strangled its people for 50 years, and now to confound the Podolsky, the current crop in the Kremlin. He told the steely-faced men in the interrogation rooms that he had no regrets, that he'd do it again. His career as a spy overwhelmed them. He was a general officer. The damage assessment would take years. He could see it in their faces. Contemplating his arrest and certain demise was made easier knowing that he had set in motion his legacy. He noted with satisfaction that Dominika was not mentioned during any of the questioning, nor was there any insinuation that she was under suspicion. She was safe. Korchnoi answered their questions and cataloged the intelligence he had provided for nearly a decade and a half to the Americans. Despite Korchnoi's total cooperation, Zhuganov told them to shift to physical means some of the old techniques from the original basement cells of the Lubyanka. It was Zhuganov's pleasure, perhaps a little payback because Korchnoi had betrayed them, the bendy cedar slivers under the nails, black and oozing red, the wooden dowels pressed between the toes, the oily knuckle pressed into the hollow behind the earlobe. In another room, the woman doctor, a urologist, looked at his face as she eased the wire up one more millimeter. When the rough stuff suddenly stopped and they left him in his cell for an entire day, Korchnoi suspected Vanya had probably ordered a halt. The next day, Korchnoi entered the interrogation room, as he had been doing for the last days, to be confronted with a display of his CIA communications equipment laid out on a table. They waited for some time before Vanya Igorov walked in, motioning the guard to get out and close the door behind him. Vanya went around the table slowly, not looking at Marble, fingering the equipment and battery packs with a faint smile on his lips. "I considered it might be you, briefly, some months ago," said Vanya, lighting a cigarette. He did not offer one to Korchnoi. "I told myself it was impossible. One of our best, the last person who could possibly engage in such disloyalty to Russia." Korchnoi said nothing, held his hands in his lap. "All those years, all our work together, life's career, everything undone so easily," said Igorov. "The trust I showed you. The love." "This is about you, of course," said Korchnoi. "It always is about you, Vanya." "Zalupa, dickhead," said Igorov, flicking his ash to the floor. "You have gravely damaged the service. You have damaged your country, forsaken Russia." He was playing it up for the microphones, thought Korchnoi. "Zalupatsya is more like it," said Korchnoi. Vanya playing the big man, taking airs. "What is it you want, Vanya? Why are you here?" Vanya looked at Korchnoi for a second, then looked at the equipment on the table. "I came to tell you that it was my niece, your protege, Dominika, who elicited the information that led to your arrest. She is a hero, and you are the Plodovyi Shev, the cankerworm." There it was, their succession conspiratia. Korchnoi said a silent word of congratulations to Benford.
Vanya watched Korchnoi's face to gauge his reaction, and was satisfied to see the older man look down, as if in defeat. He gathered up his cigarettes and pounded on the cell door. Walking down the cement corridor past the steel doors, Vanya calculated. Loss of Swan balanced out by the arrest of Korchnoi. Dominika, get her back. Myshenia Vosnia, Mice Games. Line T technical officers carefully moved the COVCOM equipment back to Marble's apartment building in Strogino to originate the transmission from the usual coordinates. A knot of quiet men huddled on the roof looking out over the blue-black Moskva River and hit send and waited for the Ruko Pozatia, handshake, from the satellite over the Arctic Circle. The uppercase Nico signature on the COVCOM transmission told Benford that Marble's message had been written by someone else, or by Marble under duress. Whatever the case, it meant that his arrest had finally come. Even though he and Marble had gone over and over the plan, Benford's instincts recoiled at the thought of his agent sacrificing himself, and he silently mourned the loss. His Mercedes covered the 25 miles on the deserted Rublyovo-Uspenskoye highway in 15 minutes, but Vanya had to wait at the reception building for 10 minutes before the duty vehicle arrived to take him through the black fir and pine forest to the neoclassical front entrance of Novo-Ogorieva. Vanya checked his watch, nearly midnight, and he inwardly shuddered at the late-night summons to the secluded presidential dacha west of Moscow. Just like you know who, thought Vanya. Uncle Joe made men wait till 3 a.m. in an anteroom superheated by a roaring fireplace. This was different than Stalin. Igorov was ushered down a curving flight of steps into a massive basement gymnasium that stretched the entire width of the building, brimming with machines and weight stacks glittering in the overhead lights. Igorov dryly noted that his Line KR chief, Alexei Zhuganov, was sitting in a chair next to an exercise station. A witness, thought Vanya. Bad sign. President Putin was shirtless, his hairless chest slick, the veins in his arms popping. His hands were through the grips of two nylon suspension straps anchored to an overhead bar. The president of all Russias leaned forward against the straps and, by extending his arms like Christ on the cross, lowered himself face forward, nearly parallel to the mat, a foot off the floor. Shaking with exertion, he raised himself up by bringing his arms together, then lowered himself, then up again. That little Ulitka, that escargot Zhuganov, never took his eyes off Putin. A matter of seconds before he would be licking the sweat off his benefactor's chest. Putin continued raising and lowering himself with hissing exhalations of breath, then stopped at maximum extension, raised his head, and looked at Igorov with eyes the color of an old glacier. Motionless, levitating. Another second, and up again. I want her out of Greece, back in Russia, said Putin thinly. He mopped his face with a towel, threw it backhanded at Zhuganov, who caught it, flustered. Putin stared, his eyes bored into Igorov's. An unsettling habit, featuring himself as a clairvoyant, a savant. Some believed the president could read minds. I'm working through several contacts, said Igorov. The Greeks are furious. Putin held up his hand. The Greeks are incapable of such outrage. They're puffed-up little birds, said Putin. We will show them Kuzka's mother. In other words, he'll bury them, thought Igorov. Right after he finishes with me. The Americans are behind the Greeks. They control everything, said Putin, moving to a bench machine with stainless handles. They will try to direct this to their advantage, to discredit Russia, to embarrass me. There it was, the ultimate transgression. Igorov refrained from replying. Zhuganov squirmed in his seat. Putin lay back on the bench and began pressing the handles above his head. A weight stack behind his head rose and fell as he pumped. Igorova is a hero, Putin said, the clanking plates echoing in the massive room.
I'm not interested in the details or in the difference between tradecraft mistakes on the street and bureaucratic bungling in Yasenyevo. I, Clank, want Clank, her, Clank, back, Clank. Vanya Igorov heard the clanking weight stack in his head, like Satan's bilge pump, all the way back to Moscow. In the back seat of a separate, less luxurious car, also speeding back to Moscow, Zhuganov knew he had a narrow opportunity to cement his standing. He assessed that Igorov was hours away from being cashiered, purged, perhaps jailed. Putin would not reinstate him, regardless of the outcome with Igorova. There were too many failures, too many mistakes. If he, Zhuganov, could retrieve Igorova, promotion and rewards would cascade around his head. He could never have guessed that the CIA would be calling him to discuss that very thing. Pasta alla Molica, anchovy salsa. Toast breadcrumbs until the color of a monk's tunic. In a separate pan, sauté anchovy fillets in oil until they dissolve into a paste. Add sliced onions, garlic, and red pepper flakes and continue cooking until onions brown. Toss cooked, drained spaghetti into pan with anchovy onion salsa. Add parsley and lemon juice and mix well. Sprinkle with breadcrumbs and serve. Chapter 39. After her arrest, Dominika had been quietly turned over to Forsyth by the Greek police and had been moved to a new safe house in the beach town of Glyfada. On a windy, rainy afternoon, Benford and Forsyth told her that there were indications almost certainly confirming the arrest of General Korchnoi by the FSB. She had set her face, emotionless. Another loss. "We lived with the possibility it could happen," said Benford. "But why now?" said Dominika. "We would have worked together. How did this happen?" Benford noticed that her concern was only for Korchnoi. She was not thinking about herself. "We're not sure," said Benford. "After the loss of the U.S. mole, Line KR has been looking for the leak. It could have been a mistake he made." Dominika shook her head. "After 14 years, I do not think so. He was too good." Forsyth studiously did not look at Benford. Forsyth's blue mantle was paler today, perhaps he was tired. In contrast, Benford exuded an inky blue. "He is working, thinking, plotting," she thought. Dominika knew something was not right. Benford looked at his hands when he spoke. "You know, Dominika, Volodya had great admiration for you." Dominika watched him carefully, how he held his hands. He definitely was working. "I believe he envisioned you as his replacement to continue his work. We thought we had 2 years, perhaps 3, to build this together. We could not have known. So now it falls to you, sooner than we want, but it falls to you nonetheless." Dominika turned to Forsyth, who reached out to pat her hand, but she moved it slightly out of his reach. There was a lot of blue fog in this room, she thought. "I am heartbroken over the arrest of the general. I will never forget him," said Dominika slowly. "But you are direct, Gospodin Benford. With him gone, you are telling me that it is Osvietsvennost, how do you say it, my responsibility to continue the struggle. That's it, isn't it? It remains only for me to decide whether I will continue working." She stopped and looked at them, reading their faces. "Gospodin Forsyth, what do you and Bratok think?"
"I would tell you exactly what Marty Gable told you," said Forsyth. "Follow your heart, do what you believe." Benford looked over at him, mouth pursing in annoyance. Forsyth could have been a little goddamn more persuasive. "Your reasons to join us were complicated," said Forsyth, who knew what he was doing, to whom he was speaking. "Friendship with Nate, your despair over the disappearance of your friend, being undervalued and mistreated by your own service.
having control of your life and career. Nothing about that has changed, right?
You should be a college professor, said Dominica, watching him waltz.
We don't want to overwhelm you, said Forsythe.
Yes, we do, Benford laughed. Damn it, Domi, we need you.
Inky blue like the tail fan of a peacock. She looked at the bandage on her leg.
I am not sure I can agree, she said. I must consider it.
We know you will, said Forsythe. If you do agree, the most important thing will be to get you back to Moscow quickly, securely. And that's why we three are the only ones who know where you are.
Not even Nathaniel, Dominica said.
I'm afraid not, said Benford, his color unchanged.
At least he's telling the truth, thought Dominica.
Awake early, Dominica stood barefoot in the spacious living room of the safe house. The triple doors were folded back, opening the whole room to the wide, marble-floored balcony over which stretched a blue canvas awning that lightly billowed and popped in the last puffs of the onshore sea breeze. Across the Glyphada coast road, the Aegean sparkled in the morning light of a sun still low on the horizon. Dominica felt the warmth building on the marble floor. She was wearing a belted cotton bathrobe, and her hair was a tousled mess. A clean bandage was tied around her thigh. Gable had gone out for bread. She jumped at the soft knock and stood to one side of the door and waved a folded newspaper across the peephole, waited, then looked out. Nate, standing in the hallway, looking down. Dominica turned the locks, opened the door. Leaning against a cane, Nate limped straight into the center of the room. She turned and went up to him, snaked her arms around his neck and kissed him. She hadn't seen him since the first safe house, after she held the IV bag above his head in Gable's car. She had sat with him the first night, but then he was gone.
"Where have you been?" she said, pulling his hair. "I've been asking about you."
She looked in shock at his purple face, which blended with his florid halo.
"You saved my life. It was my stupid mistake. I made you come to my hotel room." She kissed him again. "How are you? Let me see your hand."
She brought his hand up to her lips and kissed the back of it.
"Why haven't you come to me?"
He stepped back from her. "Were you ever going to tell me about this safe house?" said Nate woodenly. "Were you going to let me know where you were?" His words came at her, each one a deep purple disc in the air. It was as if she could feel them hitting her body. She moved out to the balcony.
"Yes, of course," said Dominica. "After a few days, Benford asked me to stay quiet for 2 or 3 days, to let things calm."
She leaned against the railing. Nate followed and leaned against the door jamb. His purple cloud pulsed as if someone were flicking a light switch on and off. Nate's hands were shaking, and he put them in his pockets.
"How did you find me?" asked Dominica.
"Everything that's going on with this case, safe houses, signals, SIGINT, is being reported to headquarters," said Nate. "I wrote some of the cables, but Benford and Forsythe apparently have written a few of their own, in restricted channels. I was able to read some of those, against regulations. I've read a lot, actually." Dominica looked at him, watched his halo, read his face, felt his anger. This was what Benford had wanted. "Do you know Vladimir Korchnoi has been arrested in Moscow?" Nate said brutally. "There's SIGINT and collateral reporting, and the Veche line in Moscow is buzzing. Do you know he's in Lefortovo?" Dominica didn't answer. "What did you say to your uncle when you called Moscow?" said Nate. His tone was flat, unemotional. Dominica's stomach felt heavy, weighted.
"Nate, Benford doesn't want us to speak of this. He was quite clear.
The cables said you called your uncle. You said that we had been together. The cables said that I had told you about the mole I handled in Moscow. Who told you to say that?" Nate stood sullenly, his hands by his sides, his color pulsing. "Do you know that your call probably got Korchnoi arrested? What did you say to Igorov?"
"What are you talking about?"
Dominica said, confused, frightened. She felt the rage building, more so because it was Nate telling her these things. She needed to ask him once.
"Do you believe I would knowingly do such a thing?" asked Dominica.
"So you didn't know?"
"It's all in the cable traffic," said Nate. "I don't care what is in the cables," she said, taking a step toward him. "Do you believe I would harm him, this man?"
She remembered Benford's instructions to say nothing. "When you didn't call me, when you went into hiding, I thought it was for security. But how could you have agreed to betray the general? Your call to Moscow was the trigger." Dominica could only stare at him.
"Did Benford tell you to do this?"
Nate ran his fingers through his hair. "You followed orders, you bought the plan. Whatever the goal, your placement as prime agent is assured. Congratulations." Purple in emotion, lava running downhill.
"What are you talking about?" said Dominica. "I did not sell anyone."
"Well, Korchnoi is in Lefortovo, thanks to your call. You're now number one. He's lost."
"You think I did this?" Dominica said. "You cannot speak to me this way."
She wanted to scream, but instead spat the words out in a whisper.
"After all we have gone through, after all that is between us."
Dominica did not permit herself to cry.
"That's not going to help Korchnoi now," said Nate.
He straightened and turned toward the apartment door. She could stop him with a word, a half dozen sentences of explanation, but she would not. The door closed on his luminous rage. Forsythe had to restrain Dominica when Benford told her that her scripted phone conversation with Uncle Vanya had indeed directly resulted in the arrest of Korchnoi.
"How dare you use me in this?" spat
Dominica as she pulled against Forsythe's arms. He steered her to an armchair and continued standing between her and Benford while she gripped the arms of the chair.
"You used me like a common donoshik, an informer."
She made to get up again, but stopped when Forsythe put up his hand.
"You're all so smart. You could not think of anything better than this?"
Benford was pacing in the living room, trailing a dark blue cape of deceit. The sea breeze blew through the balcony doors.
"We made a decision, Dominica," said Benford.
"I will tell you that Volodya conceived the plan. He insisted on it. For him, it was the culmination of his career as an agent. He had you spotted and elected and prepared as his successor before you got out of Lefortovo. He would be satisfied now." Dominica's hands gripped her chair.
"You will let him die to continue the secrets? Is the stupid information more important to you than this man?"
She got up and paced the room, her arms around her stomach, her hair in all directions.
"The stupid information is in fact the point of what we do. We all sacrifice to play the game. No one is immune," said Benford.
Dominica looked at Benford and with great force swatted a lamp on the side table to the floor, shattering it on the marble.
"I asked you if the information was more important than the man, than Vladimir Korchnoi," said Dominica, shouting.
She was looking at Benford as if she were ready to sink her teeth into his neck. Forsythe was shocked at her fury. He moved a half-step toward her in case she launched.
"To tell you the truth," said Benford, looking first at Forsythe, then at Dominica,
"no.
But we have to move forward. It is now more important than ever for you to return. That is the task at hand right now."
"More important than ever? You make me responsible for killing this man. You have maneuvered me into this position. If I refuse, knowing what you made me do, the general's sacrifice will have been wasted."
She pivoted and started pacing again.
She looked at them through narrowed eyes. The hem of her dress shivered as her body trembled.
"You are no better than they are."
"Compose yourself. There's no time for this," said Benford. "Volodya would tell you the same. You now have to prepare to return to Russia. We must take advantage of the situation. Cultivate your fame as the officer who identified the mole who passed the critical information that resulted in his arrest. You must exploit the credit within your service."
Benford's halo was as blue as an alpine lake. He was concentrating, nervous, anxious.
"Krien," said Dominica. "Bullshit. You did not tell me the truth.
I never would have agreed to this.
No one spoke. They were in the living room, motionless, looking at one another. Forsythe watched Dominika's breathing slow, saw her hands unclench, her face relax. Was she going to go along? Benford broke the silence.
We have to move quickly, he said. Dominika, are you in agreement? Can you accept this?
Dominika straightened her shoulders.
No, Benford, I will not accept this. I cannot.
She looked over at Forsythe.
I am a trained intelligence officer in the SVR, she said. I am familiar with the game. I know about sacrifice, about doing gadki meri, repulsive things for operational advantage.
She looked at them both.
But there are things more important than duty. Respect and trust between colleagues and partners. You require it from me. Why should I not require it from you?
I want you to keep in mind that this situation is what Volodya wanted. I would not want to contemplate wasting his courage, said Benford, feeling the sand slipping between his fingers.
Dominika looked at the two men for a beat, then turned and went into her bedroom, closing the door softly.
Not good, thought Forsythe. He turned to Benford.
You think she's left us? He said.
50-50, said Benford tiredly, leaning back on the sofa. We don't have much more time. If she's going back, she's got to decide the next day. Marble was convinced she'd agree. I don't want to think of the flap on our hands if we've let Marble get the chop for nothing, if she refuses to go back inside.
But that's not all, said Forsythe. Is it?
You tell me, said Benford.
You've got one final card in your hand, something that will convince her to continue.
I dislike the metaphor. This is not a game of chance.
Sure it is, Simon, said Forsythe. It's all about chance.
Benford sat on a couch under a potted linden tree in the atrium of the König von Ungarn Hotel in Vienna, in an angle of the Schulestrasse behind St. Stephen's. Benford had returned after an amusing half-hour at the Bristol Hotel with the SVR's Line KR chief Alexei Zhuganov, who had appeared wearing an inexplicable felt snap-brim hat. He was accompanied by a dark-complected young man from the Russian embassy. Over a glass of Polish vodka and a small plate of sweet-sour cucumbers, Zhuganov continued to profess ignorance of the bloodbath in Athens. He had refused to speak of Vladimir Korchnoi, other than to repeat that he was guilty of treason. He insisted that Benford press the Greek government for the immediate release of Igorova to the Russian embassy in Athens. Benford, with a straight face, told Zhuganov that the Greeks were being obstreperous and were not only interrogating Igorova about the death of the former Spetsnaz officer in the Grand Batania Hotel, but also insisting that she participate in a press conference about all her activities in exchange for a lighter prison sentence. Zhuganov sat up straight and again insisted that Igorova be released, at which point Benford made his proposal. A half hour later, a vibrating Alexei Zhuganov left the Bristol abruptly, without paying for his brandy.
That's all right, thought Benford. They're paying for it more than they could imagine.
In his Kremlin office, the blue eyes blazed and the cupid's bow mouth turned up a fraction. The politician in him instantly saw the benefit in the American's proposal. The former KGB functionary in him appreciated the operational expediency, but the strong man bent on consolidating absolute power in his retooled Russian Empire would not accept second place, not even with these stakes. Zhuganov stood in the wood-paneled Kremlin office with head bowed as his president spoke softly into his ear, a paternal hand on the dwarf's little shoulder. Bristol Hotel Cucumber Salad. Peel and seed halved cucumbers and slice thinly. Finely chop red onion and one chili pepper. Mix in bowl with white cider vinegar, salt, pepper, sugar, dillweed, and a drop of sesame oil. Serve chilled. Chapter 40.
Benford, Forsyth, and Gable were in Athens Station. They sat at one end of a scarred conference table in the secure room, a 30-foot Lucite trailer on Lucite legs inside a larger host room under the harsh light of the fluorescent tubes arrayed on the top of the trailer. Their coffee mugs added fresh heat rings to the numerous old ones along the table. Nate was down the hall in the infirmary. Some stitches were coming out.
"Going to be quite a scene if D.Va doesn't agree to return," said Gable. "The Russians will be so pissed they'll shoot marble out of spite."
Benford put a satchel on the table and unclipped the clasps on the flap. He turned to Gable. "You will be pleased to hear that you've just been elected to convince D.Va not to defect, but to return inside and in harness," said Benford. "Apart from our young superstar out there, she respects you the most. You are the only one she calls, what is it, Bratwurst?"
"Bratok," said Gable. "It means brother."
"I see. Well, brother, she views me as having betrayed her, and by extension the entire CIA. For operational reasons, we do not want to involve Nash too closely. Besides, there is a fatal strain thanks to the ill-advised physical interaction between the two." He looked at Forsyth, then pointedly at Gable. "That is why I am entrusting this infinitely delicate part of the operation to you," said Benford. "Bratok, get D.Va to agree." Benford opened the satchel and turned it upside down. Papers and glossy black-and-white photographs spilled onto the table. Forsyth stacked them and looked at each one in turn, then passed it over to Gable. The glossies showed a rural river, smooth and slow, with a slash of foam over a weir, and above it a two-lane highway bridge on concrete abutments, light poles with curving arms along the railing. Castles on either side of the river, one with a square tower, the other crenellated and squat. Rude little houses along the river and sooty apartment blocks in the distance against a gray sky. Articulated trucks with canvas tops were stacked up in a line on the bridge. "The Narva River Bridge," said Benford, pointing at one of the photos. "On the right, Russia. On the left, the West, if that's what you want to call Estonia." He spun another photo around. "Control station. This crossing is quiet, mostly trucks, very slow. Petersburg is 130 clicks north." Benford tapped the photo. "This is where she'll cross." "Why are we doing this?" asked Gable. "The Greeks could escort her to the airport and put her on a plane. She'd be home in 3 hours. Benford studied one of the photographs, then finally answered. "To use one of Forsyth's unfortunate gambling metaphors, we've broken even, more or less. On one hand, thanks to marble, we have neutralized a mole in Washington. On the other hand, we have sustained the grievous loss of marble. In exchange, D.Va has, we hope, immensely advanced her standing. I might add," he said, sipping his coffee, "that we were extremely lucky in that D.Va and Nash escaped mortal injury at the hands of that Spetsnaz assassin. For me, the one unsatisfactory aspect in all this is the ultimate price paid by a courageous old man. I tried to reason with him to continue as before, to avoid precipitate action, but he was adamant. He sensed his time was short." Benford looked at the faces around the table, then began shuffling through the photos again. "I refuse to let it go at that," Benford said, lightly slapping the satchel on the table. "I want to address the one outstanding issue."
"The one issue?" asked Forsyth.
"Marble. I intend to get him back." "He's earned his retirement," said Benford. It was quiet in the bubble. The rush of forced air coming through the Lucite vent was the only sound in the room. Gable shook his head.
"There's the small matter of his current status. Arrested Western spy," he said. "There's no work release program in Lefortovo."
Forsyth stayed quiet. He saw what was coming. "I believe the center will be glad to exchange marble," said Benford.
"Exchange?" said Gable. "Who do you propose?"
"D.Va. They want her back badly enough to let marble walk. It never would have happened with Stalin or Andropov. But this is the new Russia.
Putin is concerned about his image at home and abroad. Diva knows a secret, several secrets, that would cause him a lot of trouble domestically.
The Russians will never agree, said Gable. They'll never let Marble loose. They'll be thinking about future traitors, loss of face, looking weak.
Actually, they already have agreed. Putin will have ordered the center to make the deal.
Let me get this straight, said Gable.
You made a deal with the Russians for a spy swap without knowing for certain whether Diva will agree to return?
That is precisely why I'm counting on you, said Benford.
Besides, it is inconceivable that Diva will continue to demur when she is told that a decision on her part not to return will effectively annul the release of Marble by the Russians.
Bitchin' trump card, said Gable.
Benford looked up in annoyance.
That's no way to motivate this woman to return to Moscow as our clandestine asset. I mean, if she resents us, resents our manipulation, she might simply pull the plug out of spite. Be the last we hear from her.
I expect you to vitiate the negative aspects of our manipulation of her. Motivate her anew. Sit with her and prepare her for internal handling. Emphasize that she alone holds the key to Marble's freedom, said Benford.
Vitiate the negatives, got it. All right, I'll go out to Glyphada in an hour, said Gable.
We have a deadline, said Benford. I told the Russians we're in a hurry. We have days, hours left.
Narva, said Gable. Estonia. Jesus wept.
The two Georgians stood at attention in Zhuganov's office, looking at a spot on the wall above the dwarf's head. They were mid-grade shistilchiki, mechanics from SVR Department 5, the Wet Works, the inheritors of General Pavel Sudopladov's administration for special tasks, which had eliminated the Soviets' enemies at home and abroad for four decades. Zhuganov read from a just-received report from a Greek police informant. The thugs left. Zhuganov then called for Ludmila Tsukhanova. She entered the office slowly, chubby, hesitant, looking at her polished brown shoes over an ample, if doughy, bosom, cinched tight by a uniform jacket a size too small. Her brown hair was cut unevenly and quite short. Her round, Slav face was at first glance rosy with good health, but closer inspection revealed that the 30-year-old woman suffered from rosacea. The red blotch on her chin looked painful. Ill at ease, Ludmila sat and listened to Zhuganov speak steadily for more than half an hour. Uncomfortable as she appeared, Ludmila's black eyes, shark's eyes, doll's eyes, never left his face. When he was finished, she nodded and walked out of the office. Beneath the surface, Gable later remarked, Benford had a large case of flop sweat as he laid out the Chinese puzzle operational schedule in a narrative flood that suggested the drive belt of his tongue had slipped the flywheel of his mind. Forsyth, you must remain at station to deflect the inevitable obstreperous cable traffic from the First Lord of the Admiralty, Chief Europe, and the other savants and headquarters. I will fly ahead to Estonia to take the local young COS in hand and to liaise with the police. Kaipo, they're called, once Russian-trained, but now NATO and very earnest and intense. I expect the center to be active, ticks all over Estonia, to see what they can pick up, even try a snatch to get Diva back. You, Gable, have the most crucial task. Hide her, keep her safe. Convince Diva to return. You have one or two days in which to do this. Then deliver her, at the end of the second day, to the bridge at Narva at 1700 local. Until that time, under absolutely no circumstances, is anyone to use a phone, cell or landline. Moscow rules, is that clear? Russian SIGINT is every bit as good in tracking mobile phones, and the center still controls assets in their former satellite. I suggest, Gable, that you fly from Greece to Latvia, then make the trip from Riga in the early morning. It's 360 kilometers from Latvia on the E-67, and the Narva Bridge will be closed by Kaipo when the daily traffic subsides and before the night truck traffic begins. Gable, you must devote any available time to coach Diva on the exchange on the bridge. They'll be looking at her very closely.
I want marble out of a